It is Your Money. I'm Susie Jones, your host, and I want to welcome to the program this week Bruce Helmer, the founder of Wealth Enhancement and financial advisor, and senior vice president and financial advisor, Peg Webb. Welcome to both of you on this very, very special day. It is the winter solstice, and it is time to let go of bad behavior and start with new behavior.
I love that lead in. Good morning, Susie. Good morning, Bruce.
Oh, dear.
Good morning, Peg. Good morning, Susie Jones. Yes, thank you, Susie. And happy holidays, Merry Christmas to you and everybody. And I just love this time of year, even though in Minnesota I'm not necessarily loving the weather. Peg, I know you're experiencing slightly different weather down in Florida. Susie and listeners, Peg and I today wanted to talk about, this is not a new topic, this is a topic we've done before, but Peg, there's some alarming statistical data that we will ultimately get to. That's one reason we wanted to do this show again. And I think another reason, and Susie kind of indicated this, it's the time of year where we start looking at making resolutions, making positive changes as we head into a new year. And we're going to talk about debt and bad debt versus good debt, if there is such a thing as good debt, or inefficient or ineffective or unproductive debt versus productive debt. And we're going to give some hints, hopefully, about how to avoid finding yourself in that situation in the first place. But if you are, how to dig your way back out of it. Peg?
Yeah, we are very close to 2026, and I actually love a brand new slate. I just love starting a new year. And Bruce, you used the word resolutions. I've got some that I've kind of penciled down already. But this debt is, it's a big deal. And I'm sure there's people out there that have been shopping, and it's just such a delightful time of year. And you truly want to give. You want to give to your family. You want to give to charity. And because it's so joyous, I think sometimes people overspend. And there is statistics, and I actually was kind of shocked. Our marketing team put this outline together, and they said back in 2015, the total U.S. household debt was about $11.9 trillion. Now, that number just seems so huge. But 10 years later, 2025, it's $18.6 trillion, which I don't know if that has something to do with COVID was a really hard time. And I feel like that decade, you know, there was a lot of struggles and the government tried to help out. But the pandemic alone, you know, the COVID era was $4.4 trillion. So anyway, the good debt, bad debt, or you could call it inefficient or efficient. Now, there's interest rates on credit cards. And here we are, we're out shopping. And they're double digits. They're 20%, maybe 24%. I can't imagine, but I lived during that era when I was a young person and I leveraged on credit cards. And I didn't, Bruce, you know this story, but I didn't understand that the more you put on the credit card at that time, the more interest you're going to have to pay and that the payments were higher. So I got in a bad way when I was a young person, because my parents never used credit cards. So I didn't really understand. And yeah, we talked about it a little bit in high school, but I must not have paid a lot of attention. And I worked at Dayton's at the time in Minnesota. And I would have a break from doing my job. Well, during my break, I would go shopping and I would see all these great deals. And so I would put it on this brand new credit card that Dayton's let me had because as an employee. Well, when the first payment came, it was very small because it was just a small balance. Well, then I kind of assumed that that balance that I had to pay was going to stay the same when I was doing this future shopping. So I learned the hard way that that was really inefficient debt, Bruce.
Yeah, and I want to go back just a little bit, and I also want to talk a little bit more about good debt and bad debt. But, you know, Peg, not only is the consumer debt higher, and you alluded to this, but the terms and conditions of the debt are worse. You know, you mentioned that credit cards are typically now or often, you know, double-digit interest rates. A few years ago, it was much lower. Mortgages now, on average, are over 6%, when, you know, 5-6 years ago, it was about half that. My mortgage is at under 3%, and I've talked about it on the show before. I could pay off my mortgage. I choose not to because I think that's cheap money. I don't mind paying, you know, less than 3% on an appreciating asset. And I would call that, by the way, I would call that good debt. To me, that's an example of good debt. I took out a loan on something that I couldn't or didn't want to completely pay cash for, but it's an appreciating asset, and it's a low interest rate that I can amortize over a long period of time and actually deduct that interest. And you compare that to consumer or consumption or I want this debt that doesn't appreciate in value. Other debt that's good debt would be for your education or to improve your hireability or to improve your ability to command higher salary and so on. But so there's more debt. And I think, you know, the people during the, you mentioned the pandemic, Peg, during the pandemic, spending actually went down, you know, as the world kind of hunkered down and sheltered in place and didn't go anywhere, and they didn't spend a lot of money. And I think we came out of that, and now there's this voracious appetite coming out of the pandemic that everybody wants everything immediately, whether they can afford it or not, and they're spending way more than they should. And again, the terms and conditions of that borrowing is worse than it was, you know, 5, 6, 7 years ago. So there's a couple different problems here. People are spending money they don't have, and they're paying higher interest rates on that money. And just one last one, student loans. Now, again, we talk about the value of getting a college education, and there is, although certainly you can be successful and carve out a nice career path without necessarily going to college, but the average student loan balance is over $39,000. Think about that, Peg. You're turning a 20-something-year-old loose in the world that's got to pay rent, got a car payment, got to, you know, get food and groceries, got to live their life, and then they have a $39,000 albatross hanging around their neck of a student loan that they have to pay off. So there's no question that this is an issue, but now let's kind of segue into if you find yourself with debt, let's maybe go into some logical ways to attack that. If, again, ideally you never find yourself in this situation, but if it's too late and you're already there, what can you do about it, Peg?
Yeah, I always believe, I mean, I believe in organization, right? You can't just have a bill come in the mail and put it on the pile and then just do the minimum payment. I suggest, and especially young people, that they build their own financial statement, you know, assets, liabilities. Now, that might be a little harsh when you're that young, but why not get used to creating that type of a statement so you have a handle on, you know, maybe you are upside down, right? You don't have a lot of net worth quite yet, but yet you should start with a financial statement. And then once you see your credit cards and your debt, I like the financial statement because you can list them on there and how much you owe. Won't have the detail of what payments you're making on that financial statement, but yet you're getting organized. Now you can look at what your debt is and what is good debt versus bad debt. So we do put student loans under good debt because it's something for your future. You know, owning a home is something that historically has gone up over time. But if you look at those minimum payments and how much you have left, and it's a matter of taking the highest percentage one first. And if you could put a little bit more money down on the one that has such a high interest rate, I can't even believe 24% on a credit card, that would be hard to catch up. It'd be just hard, difficult. So you need to eliminate that one. And maybe it was a special circumstance, Bruce, where, you know, the furnace, you know, clonked out, or there was just no way that they couldn't just take that credit card. But then that's the one that you really need to focus on, Bruce.
Yeah, that's a great point, Peg. I've seen a lot of people over the years that maybe they have a couple of different bills, maybe four or five, and they pay a little bit extra on all of them every month. and it feels like they're spinning their wheels and they're stuck in the snow or they're stuck in the mud. The better way to do it is to find the most onerous one, and typically, like you said, Peg, that's going to be the highest interest rate one. And let's say you're putting, you know, $20 a month extra down on five different bills. Well, instead of doing that, maybe put $100 extra onto the most onerous one. Then when that one's gone, then you go on to the second most onerous one. That is way, way, way more efficient at, in terms of getting rid of this debt than just paying a little bit extra on all of them. Peg?
You know what I'm finding, too, and I read an article a couple weeks ago about uncollected hospital bills or hospital visits. It's expensive. It's not all free. And so maybe you have a quality job, but you already have a lot of debt. And some people are just saying, okay, I can't afford this hospital bill. So there's a lot of unpaid patient bills out there. I don't know what the hospitals actually charge or, you know, for that type of debt, but I thought that statistic was interesting. One of the things that I would always do is, you know, once again, we're going into a new year. I have got, you know, this inventory, the credits and debits, and are they good? Are they bad? But if you're someone who hasn't done that yet, it's probably a good idea to have a plan and make a plan for the next 12 months. Meaning, you know, your goal is, one of your goals is to pay down this high interest debt. And it's easier, Bruce, if you can put it into little amounts versus just looking at that one big debt you have and start putting it into 12 months, you know, and what income you have coming in. I would say, and well, I can't say that it's 100%, but there's probably some wiggle room. And I know people want to live for today, but there's probably some wiggle room to pay down that debt if you really focused on it. And yes, you might miss out on some things in 2026 because this is like a number one goal. So, but you have to convince yourself that this is what you're going to do or it's not going to happen, Bruce.
Yeah. And, you know, the other thing, Peg, that I see is sometimes people have the money to pay down this onerous debt, but they're not doing it. I'm going to make up an oversimplified example. So let's say somebody's got $5,000 balance on a 21% credit card, but they have $10,000 in the bank in a checking account, you're earning 0% interest. Well, I would tell them, I know you don't want to deplete your rainy day money, and I know that you don't want too little in the bank in case an emergency or something happens, like you said, the heat goes out on your home furnace or you need a car repair. But that's why you've got that $10,000 in the bank. If I take five of that to pay down a 21% credit card, that's why I saved that money in the first place. That's exactly what I should be using it for. It may not be an emergency, but if you're paying 21% interest on something for a long period of time and you're not, and meanwhile in the bank you're earning zero or very little interest, that just doesn't make any economic sense to me. And you can build that bank account back up again and get it back up to $10,000. But if you're carrying heavy debt and you've got the money not to pay it, 99 times out of 100, I coach that person to pay that off. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah. And what is interesting now is this money that people have in the bank and they're not really earning anything. I think most people understand that money markets were north of 5% at one point. They're not anymore. And that's the other reason I think some people kept that money in there saying, oh, I'm getting 5%. But if you're getting charged 24%, that still doesn't make sense. The other thing that happens is, and I worked with clients for so long, all of a sudden they get an unexpected bonus. And they have a list of what they want to do with that bonus to the nth degree. So I would always coach them and say, yes, go splurge on something. This is something that you didn't expect. I'm sure you worked hard for this bonus, but treat yourself to something, but then apply all the rest to debt, good debt or bad debt. I think it's, I mean, there's not 3% mortgages now, but there's things you can do with that bonus that would just be a confidence builder for the next year. The other thing I think is interesting is just making a little bit more payment on a particular credit card. And it may seem like I've already talked about that, but if you're looking at 12 months and you just said, what if it's $25 or $50? It's amazing when something costs 24% that it's a good thing to do and you can find the money. And where can you find the money? This is one of my biggest pet peeves. TV and internet, $200 to $300 a month people are paying. I've been asking people, what do you pay? What do you pay? It's $200 to $300 a month. And I find that I was talking to one of my friends and people don't really know how to investigate or find a reduction in TV and internet. And I believe it's out there. It's just hard to do, but yet it's very effective if you could lower that monthly payment. Bruce?
Yeah, and so again, now we're, and I'm glad you brought that up because that's a great point, and we did kind of gloss over it in the beginning. So I break this down, Peg, in my mind, into two areas. Number one, how do we avoid, and we've done radio shows on this recently, going into the holiday season, knowing that people like to be generous and like to spend. So we've talked about how do I avoid incurring this bad debt. And sometimes, you know, people just need to look at what they're spending. Like you said, they might be paying a considerable amount on a monthly basis for TV or for entertainment. And number one, they may not know how much it is. And number two, they may not even be using it. So if I don't want to tell everybody not to have any fun out there, but if there's expenses that you can easily eliminate, now you've got that capital that you can apply to your, you know, either to paying down debt or to enhancing lifestyle or investing or whatever, if you can reduce. So two broad categories. Number one, how do we avoid overspending? How do we avoid getting into debt? But then number two, we've been talking about what if you're already there? Now, here's what we've talked about. We talked about knowing what you owe before you go after it, or you said, you know, create your own financial statement. We talked about going after the most inefficient debt first. Usually that's the highest interest rate, or it might be the lowest balance, something you can get rid of quickly, then go on to the next one. We talked about good debt, things like student loans and mortgages that enhance your situation. But then we've also talked about this is a time where we look at a clean slate or a resolution or going into a new year. And you talked a little bit about a 12-month plan. Talk a little bit more about if you're going to take this seriously, if you're in this situation, how do they develop this 12-month plan, Peg?
Yeah, so most of us get paid twice a month. And it's a matter of kind of looking at your entire budget, not just the isolation of how high these credit cards are, just your whole budget. And that's why I brought up the TV and the internet, because that would be a budget item and a cost. And so you have to kind of deep dive into what's costing you the most, not necessarily the credit card percentage, but what are all these things that are the bills that are coming in the mail? And so, Bruce, it is an organization. I believe in an organization tool. If indeed, you know, you need help or you want to ask somebody questions, you can contact a financial advisor or a friend, or, I mean, there's other people that you could probably say, you know, I'm kind of struggling with this. Can you give me some ideas? I think people are afraid to ask for help, even if it's a friend. And so I believe that that is important. And also, you know, everybody wants to travel, especially the young people today. They all want to travel the world, and that's not cheap. And so vacations, a lot of times they're putting it on credit cards or, hey, a friend said, hey, I want to go to Europe. Will you come with me? Well, you don't have the cash for that. So people put that on a credit card saying, okay, I'll deal with that later. Bruce?
You know, sometimes in life, the answer seems simple, but it's not. You know, for example, if you're carrying more weight than you want to, well, duh, exercise more and eat less. Well, yeah, that's easy to say, and it's hard to do. If you're spending more money than you should be, more money than you earn, well, spend less. Well, duh, that's easy to say, but it's hard to do. So I love that you're talking about you know, have a plan, have a think about it, be thoughtful. And again, if you are in that situation, how do you go after it? And in about the minute or so that we have left, Peg, you don't have to go this alone. There's help available if you're really serious about it and you think you can't do it alone. How do you go about getting help?
Yeah, the first thing I would do is pull credit reports. And, you know, we've got the TransUnion, Experian, and Equifax. Get those reports, see what things look like. And then also there's counseling out there, nonprofit counseling. So often you can get free or very low cost, you know, help with budgeting. There's even companies out there, debt management planning, and their counselors, where you literally give them your authorization to organize all this debt and start paying it down. A counselor would then like pay your bills. If you can't figure it out, they're actually out there that will help you do that. So debt is a tool. It's a great use for, you know, future items like houses and that kind of thing. But we encourage people to clean up their debt, especially starting in 2026.
Yeah, and Susie, I know we're about due for a break. When we come back, we will absolutely let listeners drive most of the second half of the show and get in as many questions as we can. There may be one or two more items that I want to just reference really quickly on this whole issue of New Year, no bad debt, and let's be more economically efficient.
All mm-hmm. right. Yeah, 651-461-9226. New Year, no bad debt. If you have questions for Bruce or Peg, 651-461-9226. We'll have a whole half hour after this quick break. Your calls and texts. Welcome back to the second half of It's Your Money. Bruce Elmer, the founder of Wealth Enhancement and Financial Advisor, and Senior Vice President Peg Webb and Financial Advisor, back again to take your calls and your text at 651-461-9226. Bruce, before we get to those, did you want to add any final thoughts before we start and jump in with the questions?
Yeah, thank you, Susie Jones. Just a little bit, and of course, we'll take any and all financial questions today, Susie. They don't just have to be on today's topic. And listeners, if you joined us late, Peg and I and Susie have been talking about we're heading into a new year. We talked about good debt and bad debt. We talked about avoiding bad debt, but if you find yourself in it, how do you dig yourself back out? And the last thing we talked about before we went to break is that there's help available if you need it. And Peg talked about nonprofit credit counseling organizations, and you can get your credit report from up to three different credit bureaus, and so kind of find out where you are. Peg talked about creating your own financial statement and knowing what your debt is, where is it, how much is it, what's the interest rate, and a lot of people just don't even understand what their situation is. Understanding is the beginning of solving the problem. So we talked about all those things, but Peg, one thing we didn't hit on, I mentioned people sometimes have money in the bank earning a much lower interest rate than the cost of the debt service that they have. The other thing that has happened on occasion is I've had somebody that wants to work with me, wants to invest with me, but they've got a lot of high interest, non-deductible, inefficient debt. And I've literally told people, look, I would love to work with you, and I know cynics think that people like me just want to get our hands on your money, but probably the best thing you can do for yourself before investing money right now and earning a rate of return that might not be nearly as high as the 21 or 24% interest you're paying on that debt is to get rid of that onerous debt first, and I will show them ways to do that more efficiently, and then I'll say, look, when that's gone, that the monthly amount that you were contributing to that onerous debt, call me up, and now we can apply that to an investment. So financial advisors can also help you do that, and I'm happy to help people do that if they're in that situation. And that leads me really quickly, Peg. A couple times in the last week, I've had various questions or different questions, but the theme was, you know, what happens at an introductory meeting? What if I do want to come and see you? The introductory meetings at Wealth Enhancement, first of all, it's very important that people understand there's no cost and there's no obligation. So I like to say there's really no downside to come and see us. You've got nothing to lose. And if you don't make a favorable impression and we don't end up working together, you're not owed anything, and you might learn something that's helpful. And that doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be a client of ours. Maybe Peg or I give you some advice on how to eliminate debt, or how to fund your 401k more efficiently, or whatever. So an introductory meeting is a conversation. It's get acquainted. It's ask questions. It's make sure you're comfortable. It's to begin to establish a relationship and determine if we want to go forward or not. But one of the reasons you might want to do it is if you feel like your debt is out of control. And Peg, one of the red flags that we didn't talk about, and I did want to mention this really quickly, when I see people that ask me about borrowing from a 401k or taking money out of an IRA and they're in their 30s or 40s and they're nowhere near retirement, I would never say never, but I really don't like seeing people cannibalize their retirement plans to pay for lifestyle to date. To me, that's a huge red flag that they're spending too much or they're in a situation where they've got bad debt that they have to go into their retirement plan just to pay for their cost of living today. That's really disconcerting to me. Peg, I'll give you the last word before we go to questions.
Yeah, the only thing I really approve of if they need to go into their 401k is, if it's a down payment for a home or something that actually has value. Now, the negative of doing that where you're employed is if you want to change jobs. That's a problem because they're going to want you to have to pay that back before you go to the new company and do a 401k over there. So it has to be good debt, like a home or student loans or something like that. And I would have that be the last resort, Bruce.
Yeah, it absolutely is a last resort. All right, Susie, let's let listeners drive us the rest of the way.
All right, 651-461-9226. Let us begin. What do you think about preferred stocks? My wife and I both just retired and have about $500,000 in our account.
That's a great question. Hey, Peg, do me and the listeners a favor. I think some listeners might not even necessarily understand the difference between stocks and other investments. So maybe start with kind of a beginner course on what stocks are, and then there's different kinds of stocks. The texter is asking specifically about preferred stock. What does that mean? Maybe not only answer the question of the texter, but educate all of our listeners.
Yeah, it's interesting. I haven't heard that for a while, but very familiar with it. It actually is a hybrid. You know, it's got a feature of a stock and a bond. So there's stocks that have dividends, and those dividends are taxable. But you can, there's a lot of companies out there that have dividend stocks. But with the preferreds, they put a combination of preferred stocks and some bonds in there. And I've actually personally have owned these for years and was always a big fan until, the stock market about a decade ago was really racing and you could see that the stock market was going up. The preferreds will kind of drag your return because of the bond side. So I'm a bigger fan today of individual, buying your stock portfolio over here and buying your bond portfolio over here instead of this type of an account or this type of stock is preferred, has the both in there. And so I like the more pure stocks and bonds versus this. And why do I say that? Because the stock market and the bond market don't move in tandem. So what I mean by that is you're probably going to have your stocks maybe doing well, but those bonds are going to hold your portfolio down. And it's hard to, you can't manage it at all yourself. So it's best to probably keep them separate, Bruce.
Peg, that was a great answer. I'm going to go a little bit backwards and go even something a little simpler for people that might need this. So stocks, and again, not all stocks are created equal. There's a lot of different kinds. But if you say the word stock, you're basically saying ownership. If I own stock in a company, I'm an owner of that company. And as Peg mentioned, preferred stock puts you at the top of the food chain in terms of dividend. If the stock pays a dividend and you have preferred stock, you're at the top of the list of people that get a dividend first. And where preferred stock can be very beneficial is someone that wants a growth and income portfolio. They want return on investment, but they maybe also want current income. It might be you might have more preferred stock or funds that invest in preferred stock if you're in retirement and you're creating a growth and income portfolio. But I agree with Peg. If you're younger and it's an all-growth portfolio, preferred stock might not get the same kind of return on investment as regular stock. And then we differentiate that between bonds, which is really debt. If I own a bond in a company, I made a loan to that company, and the bond is they promised to pay me back the amount of that loan over a predetermined period of time with a predetermined interest rate for the use of that money. So in a diversified portfolio, we might have both stocks and bonds, but we have a lot of different kinds of bonds and a lot of different kinds of stocks. And as Peg mentioned, stocks and bonds generally have what we call negative correlation, and they react differently in the marketplace. And so we have both because in the short term, we never know exactly what markets are going to do. So to the texter, is preferred stock a good idea? It depends upon your goals and objectives, but based on where you're at and if you're retired and if you want income off the portfolio, I certainly don't have a problem with it. Susie?
All right, 651-461-9226. John is calling from Lakeville. John, go ahead. You're on with Bruce and Peg. Make sure your radio is down.
Yes, Peg, this is John and Mary Jo. We just wanted to thank you for all the help you gave us over the last 20 years.
Thank you. Thank you. Nice to hear your voice, John. Yeah. I transitioned some of my clients to other advisors within Wealth Enhancement Group. And so great to hear your voice. So fun working with both of you. And I hope you're all well and Merry Christmas.
Oh, that's terrific. Thank you for calling, John.
You.
A texter writes, this is my favorite show, better than the Vikings. thank you for your service. Let's see. How is the no tax on Social Security working out? Are we going to benefit?
That's a really good question. So, Peg, again, in addition to just answering the texter's question, talk a little bit, if you don't mind, on Social Security, how it works, how it's taxed, why it's taxed, and differentiate between the federal tax and then there's certain states that you also, in addition to federal tax, pay a state tax on Social Security. And the texter's probably in Minnesota. It's probably what kind of drove that question.
Yeah, because there's very few states now that that tax Social Security. Mm. There's 9 states. I keep this on a cheat sheet because I often get this question. Colorado, Connecticut, Minnesota, Montana, New Mexico, Rhode Island, Utah, Vermont, and West Virginia. Those are the only states that tax Social Security. So on a federal level, your Social Security goes on your federal tax return. And on the federal level, 85% of your Social Security goes on the front page. It's taxed. Now, there was some political things that were going on and the new $6,000 credit that if you're over 65, you get. There was kind of a theme of if I gave this credit, then you could use that credit kind of in a way of paying your Social Security tax. So they didn't change Social Security to being taxed lower. It's still taxed, 85% of it. But they came out with this 3 years, and it is 3 years, that each get $6,000 credit, if you will. And married filing jointly, that would be $12,000. So not a lot of changes there other than this extra credit, Bruce.
Yeah, and again, you mentioned there's 9 states that tax your Social Security benefit, and you might be listening in Florida or, you know, a lot of different places other than Minnesota, but the show originates in the state of Minnesota, and Minnesota is one of those 9 states. But Peg, I think, and I don't know where the line is, I think you can avoid state Social Security taxes if your income is below a certain level. So if your income is too high, you pay taxes on your Social Security state taxes, But some people can avoid it, but I think it's driven by income. But I'm not 100% sure, and even if I'm right, I'm not sure where they draw that line. But the frustrating thing is that in Minnesota, both political parties have said they want to do away with state taxes on Social Security. But what ends up happening is, rather than just treating that as a separate issue and voting on it, it's part of a bigger bill where they don't agree, and then it doesn't pass. And so this one issue keeps getting, you know, the can keeps getting kicked down the road, and most people are still paying taxes on their Social Security benefit. But Peg, a lot of people that are listening right now that maybe haven't reached the age where they're drawing Social Security might be surprised at this. They maybe didn't know that when they get to the age where they draw, that they're going to have to pay taxes on it. And I've heard the comment frequently, well, that, how is that fair? I paid taxes into the system when I was working, my FICA taxes. Now you're going to tax me again when I spend it? Aren't you taxing me twice? And I always say, don't shoot the messenger. Don't blame me. I didn't make the law. I'm just telling you what it is, Peg.
Yeah, and with that money that they take out of our paycheck, it's not unlimited. You know, there's a limit to how much they'll take out of our paycheck on an annual basis. And so in all fairness, a lot of times that particular pot of money is smaller than maybe a lifetime of taking Social Security. So that's their view of how that looks. But I think, you know, with Social Security, one of the things I wanted to point out is there's a lot to saying, I'm turning on my Social Security. And I think we have a show coming up in the new year here about Social Security again, because there's so many questions. Should I, you know, one of you take the Social Security and one of you not take the Social Security, and you can play off each other. And so I feel like, I know the taxation is a big deal, but it's a very valuable income source, in my opinion, because I've done this for a long time. It's a valuable income source for people long term. Bruce?
Yep. No, I agree. And again, not to belabor the point, I think some people, you know, thought that Social Security should or would be their sole source of income at retirement. For most people, it should only be, you know, a part of your retirement income, maybe 30-35%. If you're in a situation where you think you can live completely on your Social Security benefit, that might be the unfortunate reality, but that certainly wouldn't be my goal as a financial advisor or a financial planner. I would want you to have other sources of income in addition to your Social Security benefit. Susie?
All right, 651-461-9226. A texter writes, which would you like better for a self-employed person, an SEP IRA or a solo 401k? Thank you.
So, Susie, the question here, there's a lot of different types of retirement plans within companies. So most people listening right now are familiar with a 401k, or maybe if you're in a public sector, a 457, or if you're in the school district, 403b. These are all different. The names come from the section of the tax code that they're in, but they're all plans that allow employees to put away dollars within the retirement plan on a pre-tax basis. What the texter's asking about is if it's not one of these more traditional plans, certain small companies or sole proprietors or even independent contractors might be able to set up a retirement plan, the SEP, the Simplified Employee Pension, or SEP IRA, or Peg Solo 401k. I don't know exactly, Peg, what plans are eligible for. There also sometimes can be a difference whether your corporation is a sub-S corporation or a limited partnership. So different types of corporate structure have different plan eligibility. And so what's the best? I'm not sure how to answer that. Peg, can you offer some additional insight?
Well, I had been leaning and have been leaning towards the solo 401k for quite some time. And one of the reasons that I recall doing that is because the catch up, you know, so if you're 50 and older, you were able to put more in. a lot of the people that are doing a solo 401k, they might actually have an employee, you know, where they're putting some money in for one of their one of their employees. And so those were the two reasons. And the amount that you could put in if you don't have an employee and you're trying to make a decision is, I believe it's the same. So it's not like you can put in more other than this catch-up feature that I recall, Bruce.
Yeah, and again, to the texture, if it feels like we didn't do a good job of answering your question, it's a good question, but it can get very complex, very complicated. In fact, there's actually a segment in the financial services industry. They're called third-party administrators, TPAs, that Wealth Enhancement will work with to determine, you know, depending upon your company, depending upon your situation, what plans are you even eligible for, and based on the specific circumstances, what is the best plan for you? Because there's a lot of them. Everybody knows 401k, but there's a lot of them that you haven't heard of, and SEP and solo 401k are just two of many. So it's a good question, but it can get very complicated. Susie, I think we've got time for at least one more.
All right, this is a good one. Good morning. I'm thinking of retiring in a few years. We've been looking at getting a prepaid funeral plan that we can make payments on at this time. Is this a good investment or a poor investment for the future? There's no interest on it.
That's a great question. Peg, you must get this, because this is not the first time we've heard this.
We do.
So yeah. Pre-planning or prepaying your last expenses, your funeral or whatever includes last expenses.
Yeah, I'm a big fan. I mean, it depends on your age, and I fear sometimes in the future whether that company will still be there. You know, what is the, you have to look at the details as to what's your guarantee, because if you're 60 years old and you're going to die at 90, I mean, who knows what everything looks like at that point in time. But there's clients that, you know, feel more confident having that all done. And a lot of the reason that they do it is because they don't want the family to have to deal with it, Bruce.
Yeah, that's the biggest reason probably. But also there's the issue that the costs are rising. And if I pay for it now, I'm going to save money because the costs are only going to go up. Even if my last expenses are a decade or more away, why not pay for it now? And I agree with you. In general, I'm in favor of it, but obviously every situation is different. And I'm not trying to give a plug, but I like what you said, Peg. Yeah, you want to make sure you're working with somebody that's going to have staying power. So my friend Bill McGreevy is going to love that I say, you know, the firm that you know of that's been around and is probably going to be there in the future, that's one thing. If you're not sure, then it makes less sense. So, yeah, go, if you're going to do it, go with somebody that you know has got staying power, has got legs, is going to be there 20 years from now when you actually leave this world. Susie, I think that's about it. I think we're almost out of time. Great last question, though.
Yeah, wonderful. And thanks to everyone for asking your questions. And if we did not get to them, you can certainly follow up with Wealth Enhancement. That number to call is 1-888-6-ADVICE. Bruce, are you guys going to be in the office at least Monday and Tuesday?
I am, absolutely. I got a full day tomorrow. Thanks for asking.
Well, let's you tell people 888-6-ADVICE. Call. You can get a free consultation. You can also email your questions to yourmoney@wealthenhancement.com. Listen, you two, happy holidays, and we'll see you next week.
You too, Susie. You too, listeners.